Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin is home to the nation's only Master Cheesemakers program that provides innovative cheesemakers with continuing education opportunities? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
Hello and welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. On today's show, we have executive chef Jeremy Salomon of the Eddie in the East Village. He discusses with us how his Hungarian grandmother being proud is not the same as her approval. Later on, we have Elke live in studio who talks about finding herself in another person's persona. So welcome, sit back, and enjoy another week's episode of Snacky Tunes.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, Snacky Tunes.
You only call me when you're drunk, to tell me we were once in love. I don't answer anymore, and you sing our old song when she says record. Drunk, the sedative was not enough. I don't answer anymore, and you sing our old song when she says record. You said love you without the eye, a non-committal alibi. Sing yourself to sleep.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I am one half your host, Greg Bresnitz. That was just Elke, who will be performing live in studio later on. But first up, Jeremy Salomon, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you?
Welcome to Snacky Tunes.
Thank you for having me here.
We almost got through a little bit of small talk.
Yes, we managed.
We almost got there. Weather.
Yes.
Trips.
Yeah, we covered it all.
We covered grandparents, grandmothers.
Yeah, that's the important stuff.
And we both have Hungarian grandmothers.
Oh, okay. Yes, that's right. Did tell me that. Mm-hmm.
Which is where you learned to cook?
Yeah. I mean, I learned from both grandmothers, sure. But the Hungarian cuisine came from my Hungarian grandmother.
What did you learn from either grandmother? Or what do you remember? Like, did they have different techniques or different dishes?
Sure. Yeah. My mom's mother, she really taught me how to like make a great roast chicken and like the perfect chocolate cake.
That's the Hungarian grandmother?
That's my mom's mother. She's not the Hungarian one. She's actually a Sephardic, which is like Jewish Greek. And then my father's mom is the Hungarian one, Agi. And she taught me, how to just like cook Hungarian cuisine, how to like cook in big batches, how to feed like 50 people at once.
I mean, I remember a lot of browns and oranges and like not anything that's particularly nothing that you would call Instagrammable.
Yeah, no food porn.
No food porn at all, but just, you know, very delicious, long time cooking, patience beyond patience.
Yeah, it was all just like gray, red sauces. Nothing really that appealing, but all delicious.
And she also, like my grandmother and my grandfather, fled Nazi Hungary. Mm-hmm. Well, they didn't flee. They were in Auschwitz, so I guess they didn't make it. But she escaped?
Yeah, she escaped, and her husband, my grandfather, who he passed away in 2005. They both escaped. My grandfather has this really crazy story where basically he stole Nazis' clothes and like walked out of the camp, hid in a wine cellar. And my grandmother swam across a river with a huge fur coat, and she survived on lemons for a few days. It's like absolutely amazing. But she's still kicking, and she's actually quite a pistol. So
that is pretty impressive. And did they, I mean, our grandparents had a really interesting relationship with food as we were growing up. Like, you had to finish all your cereal, all your food, nothing could be wasted. Do you find similar?
Yeah, I was always way too skinny. Even like, you know, when you're a teenager and you like feel really fat, but you look really skinny. And I always had to, be eating when you went over to our house. Both grandmothers, I mean, Jewish grandmothers always need to feed you. So,
and what were some of the dishes that you remember from your youth? And what were some of the things that kind of stuck with you as you began to like develop your culinary palate?
Yeah, some of the dishes growing up. It was interesting because I learned something different from like the women in my life. So my mother and both my grandmothers. My mother was more of like necessity, cooking for us after school, meatballs and lasagna, you know, kind of like those quick fixes. And then her mother really just taught me how to cook more like French food, Greek food, how to like roast that chicken. I remember brisket and kugel being like huge staples in my diet, especially on Friday and Saturday nights. And my Hungarian grandmother was always palacinta, which is like a Hungarian crepe, and also fried veal cutlet. So a lot of heavy foods growing up, now that I think about it. I was probably a very fat child.
I mean, brisket for us was always more of like a specialty, like Passover type of meal. I don't remember like too much brisket on the regular.
Yeah, no, we were a brisket loving family, and we used to have, I think, Lipton onion soup mix was combined in that like sauce with fried shallots on top of it. It was I had that pretty much every other week, I think.
My mom made this chicken growing up, and my brother and I begged her to know the recipe, and she never would. And then one day she's like, okay. And it was a bottle of French dressing, 8 ounces of apricot preserves, and a packet of the Lipton's French thing. And that was it.
Apricot preserves are that's the secret ingredient to everything. So kind of like finding out that the tooth fairy is, or Santa Claus isn't real. You know, you just
find, as a Jewish kid, was it hard to find out that Santa Claus wasn't real?
I mean, what was cool is that I had that advantage of knowing already, you know, about my friends. And then my parents would be like, don't tell other, you know, kids. So,
I mean, apricot preserves, you're just like, oh, this like puts texture in, and it's a sweetness. Yeah. And it's just, yeah. But you found, when we found out the recipe, we went, everything's a sham.
Yes, basically. And also, you know, when you'd find out like people would put soy sauce, I'd probably, my grandmother put soy sauce in a lot of things. So yeah.
And you grew up in Florida,
mm-hmm.
and what type of cooking jobs did you have there, and what was the restaurants you got your start in?
Sure. I think my first cooking job was at my Yeah, my grandparents' country club. This is my non-Hungarian grandparents, and I started out scooping ice cream or sorbets for big banquets, like 200 martini glasses of just like three different flavors of sorbets and gelatos. They'd give me a freezer jacket, and I would like listen to music and sit there for 2 hours in the freezer.
What was on your playlist?
I remember Elton John and the Beatles because my father was really big into Elton John and the Beatles. And also, I think ABBA. I listened to a bunch of, like, actually pretty good music for that age. And occasionally some pop stuff. You know, Britney Spears, I definitely rocked out to a lot.
Just, like, who was the soundtrack to get, like, the fastest 200 glasses filled? Who really kicked things into high gear?
Whitney. Yeah.
Like, do you hear that song now and it takes you right back to the freezer jacket and the three scoops?
Yes, absolutely.
And then what came first? Was it coming to New York and working at Bouvette and Prune, or did you travel to Hungary?
It was first, I came to New York when I was 18 to attend culinary school. I went to the CIA and then I dropped out. But it was after that I was at Prune, Bouvette, and La Conda Verde. And then the Eddie, where I'm the chef now. But
why did you drop out?
I dropped out because I couldn't learn how to saute from a textbook anymore. I'd also just come from a working background my entire life, and I just missed that hustle. I learn better by doing. So
when you graduated from scooping sorbet mm-hmm. to cooking in Florida, and then you got into the almost, did it feel like a setback almost coming to culinary school where, like, I know how to do this?
A little bit. I mean, I would never want to come off as like cocky. I mean, sure, there was things that like you just obviously know, especially if like you've been working in kitchens. And I did learn a few things for sure. But it just, they were just really hard on like you got to learn how to do this from a textbook. And that's not how I learned. So. Mm.
So of the three places, the Conde Verde, Bouvette and Prune, what did you pick up there and, you know, kind of each of three, like what were some of the lessons you took away? Because they are relatively different kitchens and experiences.
Yeah, I think I took away how to, especially from Prune, Gabrielle is such a talented, amazing chef. I think from her, I was taught how to cook simply, but, you know, that everything is like elegant and beautiful and it should be the best quality if you're going to do something really simple. And I think that also carried over to Bouvette. Jody kind of has that same ethos, like just cook simply, but make sure it's like the best of the best ingredients that, and when it's plated, it's absolutely like, it's unassuming. You don't know, like you're about to have this flavor trip in your mouth. And La Conda was my first introduction to like a real big brigade system in Manhattan, you know, whatever, like 10, 12 line cooks, and there being like tiers and layers of like garmage cooks and tournants and junior sous chefs, like four junior sous chefs and like, you know, three different sous chefs, and being able to communicate across the board and find your way in that sort of kitchen. That's how, you know, I learned how to like really hustle. From La Conda.
And how was that shift going from a very small kitchen to being almost part of a much larger team and being hyper focused on one area or a couple areas as opposed to when you're focusing on almost everything?
Yeah, that was a big shock. A lot of crying in the walk-in refrigerator.
Why?
Just it's strange because you said it right, that in a smaller restaurant, you're so hyper aware of everything that's going on. Everything's happening so close to you. So something that's not your responsibility all of a sudden is, whereas like in a bigger restaurant, you have to like cutting that cucumber for the garmage station is like the most important thing of your day, and you can't do anything else. So it definitely was overwhelming and hard not to attend to those problems.
What was the decision for you to go to Hungary? And how long were you there?
Yeah, so I went to Hungary after my tenure as sous chef at the Eddie, and about and this relates, about 7 and 6 years ago, I found this cookbook that was written by George Lang, who's a Hungarian restaurateur, and it was the only and first ever Hungarian cookbook I've come across, the cuisine of Hungary.
It's on my shelf.
Oh, yes. It's quite an excellent, extensive, thought-out book that's really beautiful, and it was the only copy at the Strand bookstore, and I freaked out. I called my grandmother, and I'm like, why didn't you tell me about this? And, you know, that's no good answer for me. So, and I just kept reading through the whole, like, first whatever 100 a few pages are, like, a history of Hungary. And I, like, took a highlighter and just went through it and was like, this does not seem like the cuisine that my grandmother taught me or I knew, and I just became really fascinated by it. So, over the years, it's just the urge to go back, because I'd been there a few times when I was younger, grew. So yeah, that's where it stemmed from. And when I was finished being a sous chef at the Eddie, I decided to go over.
And how did you set up the trip? Did you stage? Did you explore? Did you just eat? There's so many different ways to go. Mm-hmm. Did you have relatives there, connections? How did it unfold?
Yeah, I have relatives there. Actually, a whole bunch. I have a whole family there. My grandmother's nephew, and it's really like that connection and his whole family. So I decided that I was contemplating working, but I did not want to learn how to speak Hungarian, especially when I was like trying to learn about something so specific as their cuisine. If just to be there for, I don't know, 6 months, a year, Hungarian is one of the hardest languages to learn. And yeah, I just wanted to spend time eating and cooking, but like home cooking. So I traveled around. I stayed in Nógrád, which is like north of Budapest, with my cousins. And then I went to Budapest, where they also have a home, and just traveled to different wine regions, different farms, did a lot of home cooking. So yeah.
And what were some of the dishes, and more importantly, any of the techniques that you brought back from there?
Sure. They, in Hungary, they're really big on preserving and making your own like spices. So obviously like paprika or ground caraway, preserving sour cherries, making palinka, which is it's like a plum or apricot sort of alcoholic beverage. And like making a lot of pastries. That's a big... a big thing there. So, and layering, everything gets layered, like layered cabbage, dobos tort, which is like a 11 layer chocolate cake, basically. So what I brought back was that the whole preserving thing, and also layers. Like there's never enough layers, there's never enough flavor in any of Hungarian cuisine.
Was 11 the most layers you saw, or do you see something that was so preposterous and you're like, come on?
Yeah, no, I think 11 layers is where it ended. I'm sure there's got to be something out there that beats it. So
there's someone out there who's just the layer queen.
Yes.
Of Budapest.
Absolutely.
No one makes more layers.
We were contemplating at the restaurant doing, like, I told my sous chef, well, let's do a dobos tort. And he's like, oh, that's 11 layers. I was like, yes. So we're going to do 20 layers. And it'll be huge. And food pouring across the board.
And then people from Hungary will come and eat at the they will see this and they will book plane tickets. And a restaurant will be full.
Yes. So done deal.
We're going to take a quick musical break, play a song from our archive. And we'll be back on Snacky Tunes with Jeremy here on Heritage Radio Network. So let's take one step back. After La Buvette and Prune and the Conde Verde, you found yourself at the Eddy. How did you make your way there, and where did you start?
So if you're going chronological order, so the Eddy was after Buvette and Via Carota, and I just started applying to 100 different places. I had to find a job quick so I could afford my place in Harlem. And yeah, I happened to cross the Eddy. The chef was Brendan McHale, who I love and adore. And he was just doing unique food that was a take on like Catskill, like Northern New York, fishing and game and going to the market ourselves like 4 or 5 days a week. So I was really into that. And I applied and just started out as the line cook there. And then just worked my way up.
What was the cuisine when you got there?
So it was more of, I don't want to say cats. Yeah. So like Catskill, like lots of fish. Brendan was super into, fly fishing. So there was all sorts of fish on the menu, different crudos and octopus. And he changed up the fish like biweekly, but yeah, now not so much fish.
And it's really interesting. I mean, it is Hungarian inspired food.
Mm-hmm.
How did you begin to approach changing a menu while keeping the same name? I mean, it's not so often that a restaurant will go so hard to like a completely different background, inspiration, and focal point. It might go a little bit to left, a little bit to right, pulling a little bit here, but it's very different from where it began.
Yeah, that's something that we struggle with a little bit, especially because the name Eddy, I mean, that could be like my great uncle or something that was Hungarian. I don't know.
Well, my dad's name is Eddie.
Okay.
Of Hungarian descent. Spelled Eddy, not short for Edward or anything. So when I saw it, I was like, oh, of course.
Oh, great. Eddie. Okay, so we'll just go with that.
Yeah. that's like, awesome. It was the host of this podcast's father's name,
yes,
Eddie.
There you go. Yeah. It's not a calm spot in a river.
Yeah, that's no, it's not. It's a guy's name. Born of Hungarian descent.
It is still difficult to find that balance of we didn't want to fully go Hungarian, because we didn't want to scare people away. We didn't want to become just another like destination weekend spot. We had to find that balance of being approachable, but also, something new and unique. And especially teaching this generation of Manhattan, what Hungarian cuisine is or was, and translating that into modern day food is a really difficult task. So kind of combining all different aspects of my past. So that might be some Jewish influences and some Southern influences, taking staples like chicken liver and mussels, and trout, and taking things that people are familiar with, but then combining them with different flavor profiles of Hungarian cuisine.
If someone who had no idea came in and asked, what is the essence of Hungarian cuisine? How would you describe it?
What's the essence of Hungarian cuisine? Paprika. That's it. If you put paprika in anything, it's automatically Hungarian. That's partly true. But Hungarian cuisine is... It's like a celebration. I think that's really what... I know that's like a very big answer, but that's really what it is. In Hungary, they will like lots of food, lots of people. And they'll have like giant sheet cakes with plums in it, and they'll have paprikash and goulash, which are, you know, these meaty stews that come in huge cauldrons. And it's like you can never have enough food, and there's never enough people to feed, and there's never enough drinks. So yeah, I think that's really what Hungarian cuisine is.
And what is a dish that you feel really is a symbol of modern Hungarian cuisine that made it on there? And how do you trace back the roots of how it came to be?
I think palacsinta for me sums it up. And that came from my grandmother. And in Hungary, In Hungary, palacsinta is primarily eaten. It's a Hungarian crepe. You add a little seltzer to it at the end. It's a bit eggier than a normal like French thin crisp crepe. But you eat it with dessert. And normally, it's stuffed with like jams and fruits and nuts, and finished with like chocolate sauce and whipped cream. But also, you can use it as like a naan and stuff like braised chicken paprikash in there, or do pork belly inside of it, and just kind of use it to grab different pickles. So I think that's a really fascinating staple dish of Hungarian cuisine. Also chicken paprikash, but palacsinta is, for me, that touches on home, because my grandmother used to make that every Sunday night.
Have you cooked for the Hungarian grandmother with your modern interpretation, and what has been her response, if so?
Unfortunately, I've not been able to cook with her and give her my modern-day interpretation of it. She's just... it's hard for me to get down to Florida, and she's in her 90s now, so even, like, me just coming in and cooking for her is a whole to-do. But hopefully I will get the opportunity to do so. I have spoken to her over the phone, and she's... I don't know if she approves. I think she just, obviously she'll never tell me that. She just always tell me how proud she is. But when I told her that I was doing like this palacsinta with just blueberry jam, because blueberries are in season, and it got topped with this toasted meringue, she was like, that's nice. But have you considered putting like Yoo-hoo chocolate syrup in it and finishing it with some sweet and low? She's like, oh God. Like, so I think her vision of it is now a little twisted, but since age has done that to her. But yeah, I did make chicken paprikash back in the winter and did my own thing on it. And I sent her some photos and she was super proud. So
my grandmother makes this chocolate cake that part of the recipe comes from that, mm-hmm. that book. And, you know, that's like coffee liqueur and mm-hmm. instant coffee, and like the cake mix is just like from Duncan Hines.
Yeah.
And I when I made it the first time, a part of my childhood was both forever enshrined because I can now make it, and then quietly died as well because I realized how this tasted good, because a lot of this was not real.
Mm-hmm.
Very chemically driven.
Yeah. I feel that, no, I mean, she didn't do a lot of cake mixes. Both my grandmas actually didn't do a lot. What bothered me the most was mashed potatoes came from a box. That was mind-blowing to me. Now I look back on that and I was like, I mean, it's still delicious, but it's incredibly mind-blowing.
One of the other aspects is you run A Nice Kitchen. You're a proud member of the LGBTQ community.
Yes.
Did you find any struggles coming up through the culinary world that we're hearing about, and how did your experiences influence the way that you run your kitchen?
Sure. I didn't struggle, I would say, but I definitely was, you know, I witnessed or was subjected to, you know, kind of that like toxic masculinity in the kitchen, that you had to act a certain way, or if you brought up anything that was just outside the realm of, you know, like a dick joke or, you know, Star Wars or, you know, I don't know, just something like really foul and kind of just really messed up, or doing cocaine, like that was like, you were automatically like, you were gay. Didn't like, there was, I used to work with somebody who was just like flamboyant, but he was very certain about his sexuality, and everyone would, they would just tease him, call him gay all the time. And because he acted a different way. So witnessing that, I knew that one day when I ran my own kitchen, that was just, everyone would be treated fair and equal. And if you wanted to listen to Whitney or ABBA, or if you wanted to talk about the Broadway show that you saw yesterday, or whatever it is, whatever you want to talk about, that was okay. So, so yeah, that's how I run my kitchen now.
And do you have to course correct anybody that comes in from other kitchens, or, and if you do, how do you break them of bad habits?
Old habits die hard. And, you know, I can't worry about an older line cook that comes in that might have been there, or, you know, and how they feel about, you know, A Nice Kitchen. I can't really, I just have to be myself. My sous chef has to be himself, and our kitchen will just flow naturally. If I sit there and think about how I can kind of break the mold or break them, that's, it starts getting very technical and detailed, and that's just, I have bigger fish to fry. So it's either like, hop on board this train, you know, we're teaching you, you know, I'm giving you the respect and I hope that you'll give me that respect back. But it's proven to be a real challenge, for sure. It's not easy. And I'm sure other chefs and cooks across Manhattan and across the country are currently dealing with it. Because there is a shift in this, in our industry, a big shift, and it's not finished yet. So, I applaud anybody that is trying to reassess their kitchen and give it a better environment.
Do you have a success story of someone that came in completely old school and after 6 months to a year was like, I get it, and I feel that this is better?
Not yet, no. Everyone, for the most part, has been really wonderful to work with. You know, everybody has their thing, but and things to work on, but everybody has been just so nice to each other, and there's just like, you know, I think once I set the bar, like in the precedent that like you can be whoever you want to be in this kitchen as long as you show respect to everybody, you treat everyone fairly, then I don't know, then it works out.
Well, so, chef, yeah. Thanks for coming.
Yeah, thank you.
Where can people find you? How can they make reservations? How can they come eat your modern interpretation of Hungarian cuisine?
Sure, yeah. We're at The Eddie, your father.
Yes. You can retro namesake.
Yes. So we're The Eddie. We're located on East 6th Street between 2nd and 1st Ave. That's the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And you can make your reservations online at OpenTable or through the website at theeddienyc.com. And I do have an Instagram, Jeremy Cooks, @JeremyCooks.
Perfect. So that wasn't taken?
No, it wasn't.
I was surprised when like a good one is just sitting there.
Just so easy.
Well, thanks for coming. We're going to take another quick musical break from our archives, and then we'll have Elke live in studio here on Snacky Tunes on Heritage Radio Network.
Tired heart now, darling, lift it up into the air, and I will notice you in this crowded room and whisper in your ears. Lift your tired head now, darling, lift it up into the air, and I will float to you in this crowded room. Let's get us out of here.
Losing, to me you're the wall, I know love, for you're Lily.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh, and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the Farmstead Cheese Company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious, stinky Limburger and its long-storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Sertori's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk. Fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country. To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
This week, it's the season finale of Meat and Three. We're following up our episode about youth with a look at age and how aging affects life on farms and in kitchens.
At the most basic level, we need people to grow food for a growing global population.
The question of planning for retirement or old age as a cook, it's almost one that doesn't exist bizarrely until it's too late.
We also have a story about a food that might be older than you think.
A recent archaeological finding might have CrossFitters everywhere reevaluating their diets.
Plus, a story about one of Atlanta's most historic and risque landmarks.
There are dancers that have been there 20 and 30 years.
Don't miss our season finale of Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Snacky Tunes. Alki, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So you came to New York as Kayla.
I did.
And you were a model.
I was.
And then that didn't happen anymore.
No, it didn't.
But you had one of the best lines for bios that I've read, and I just want to read it. It said, "You kind of hung around New York until Alki arranged herself around you." It's a beautiful sentence.
Thank you.
How did she arrange herself, and when did Kayla become Alki?
Well, I still, you know, funnily enough, kind of feel like Kayla. Like, I kind of feel like Alki is this thing that I'm always reaching for. But it's matured over time in a way that I've enjoyed a lot.
When did she first show up? And how did you realize it was something besides yourself?
It was when I stopped depending on people. Because I was always kind of collaborating or finding a way through other people to feel comfortable. And I got to the point where I just sat with myself for probably like a year. And it kind of like all of it came together.
And what were the early hints? I mean, it's so interesting about people developing personas outside of themselves almost as like, well, I wouldn't do it. But Alki would.
Yeah.
Like, same. Kayla would never do that. But Alki, she's totally, that's a totally Alki. When did that become, and how did you name her?
Well, I named her because, so my grandmother's name was Alki. And when she had my mother, she put Alki where, she put her name where my mother's name was supposed to be. She was born in Spain, so she couldn't.
Backwards.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So out of order.
It's completely out of order. So there's just this Alki. It's kind of like ironically, it's a family name, and I've actually always wanted to use it as a band name, and the moment that I realized how powerful that name was and how much it meant to me, and the power behind not being able to meet somebody, it not to be possible to meet someone you've always wanted to meet. It's kind of like it's a fire for me.
And when you perform, is it full Alki? Or is there sometimes in moments Kayla shows up on stage like, oh God, get me out of here?
No, okay, well, when Kayla, it's funny because the way that Kayla and Alki interact with each other, I suppose, is a good balance. And Kayla likes being there. Alki likes being there. Elkie's just a little more... Elkie's more of a performer and more of like the who you would see on the billboard. But I like that Kayla's still there and that I still feel like Kayla because I'm a person. I like going back and forth between this grand, like, strong, like, vision of who I want to be, but also still being myself. It's like...
When I was starting out and doing events and planning, I felt very limited within my creativity, but I had a friend who I thought was the top of the game. So whenever I would get challenged, I would just say, well, if I was them, what would they do? Mm-hmm. And then that eventually became what would I do? But I never asked them. I just imagined them. And somehow the disassociation allowed me to like find new levels of creativity. Do you feel that when you're writing or performing or anything that you go, well, I couldn't do it, but what would Elkie do? Or how would she do this? Or how would she approach this? Or is it just another variation of yourself?
I actually never think of it like that. Like when I'm writing, I feel, it's funny, writing is kind of like meditation to me. I know the idea of meditation is not to think at all, but when I write, I'm thinking so well. Like it's a direction and it takes me somewhere and it's me, it's Kayla. And I feel like the way that Elkie gets involved is just kind of through like the strength. Because like I write about feeling weak and I write about feeling strong and I write about everything. But then I guess Elkie would take that and project it. So I always feel like Kayla until it's time to like give people a slap in the face. Like a here I am feeling.
Can we hear a song?
Absolutely.
What are you going to play for us first?
So the first song I'm going to play is called Asshole. Am I allowed to swear? Sweet.
Okay. It's a podcast.
So no, it's a rules. This is one I actually recently wrote, and it has a bit of a country vibe to it, which is something I've been messing with. Something doesn't add up when I'm told what you've done. A name to a face that just doesn't grab on. Your actions reflect how much you hate yourself. Your dark black hole is in no way our fault. An asshole ain't an asshole unless you give him the power. Change a better word. A weenie is a coward. Don't prove yourself to a weenie. It's not worth the time. Reassurance. Yeah, yourself is just fine. So when you're approached by an asshole, take a quick moment to see if you did something wrong. But if that asshole is just an asshole, gracefully you can do whatever you want. But remember kids, always be smart. An asshole ain't an asshole unless you give him the power. Change up that word. That weenie's a coward. Don't prove yourself to a weenie. It's not worth the time. Reassurance. Yeah, yourself is just fine. An asshole ain't an asshole unless you give him the power. Change up that word. A weenie is a coward. Don't prove yourself to a weenie. It's not worth the time. Reassurance.
Your debut EP came out in June, Bad Metaphors, about breakups and past relationships, three songs. Is it three breakups or is it three songs about one really bad breakup?
It's like every breakup ever in a blender.
So is there multiple breakups within one song?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
There are actually.
All right, pick one song and break down the breakups in the song.
So, Without the Eye, actually, is...
Which is what opened up the show.
Which is, yeah. that song is... It's actually there's a lot of different people in that song. They're all men. You Only Call Me When You're Drunk was from my first relationship in the city. He was my first love. And we had a really long kind of childlike, beautiful love, but it was not sustainable. And he was awful in so many ways and wonderful in so many ways. But that lasted for a really long time, probably years after we'd broken up. It took me a long time to unclench him. And he would call me when he would get drunk at you know, after the relationship had ended. And he always kind of seemed to keep coming into my life. And there's actually a direct line from a song that says, I watched you tear apart your home. You shaved your head. We spent that night fully clothed in the tub. Different boyfriend. He was a... I also had a strong love for him as well. We were kind of in we both were figuring out who we were at that point, and it wasn't good. It wasn't fun. It wasn't pleasant. It was directed at each other, and he did that. That happened. Like I came over to his apartment, and he went nuts and just like took everything out of his closets. He like tried to shave his head, like, and then like it ended with him just running a faucet of water under his head, and I just sat in the tub with him. And another, I also get drunk calls from my dad. So like I always get voicemails of him singing to me. So, and there was a time where we really had to work through our relationship, just kind of growing up and realizing that your parents are people. They're not your saviors. They're people who raised you. So I actually think that he had a bit of a relation to that as well.
What would he sing to you?
Oh my gosh, he loves the Beatles. He always sings the Beatles.
Any particular song? And is it early Beatles or like psychedelic Beatles?
Early Beatles. Okay. Definitely early Beatles. Like catchy. He's my dad was born in the 40s, so I actually heavily influenced my music because I really like doo-wop, and a lot of that came heavily from my father.
Can we hear another song? Can we hear that song?
Which one?
You Without the Eye.
Yeah, absolutely.
No longer missing. Sing yourself to sleep tonight.
You started in pop music and then you went to country and to shoegaze, but it wasn't really until you found and owned your voice that you started writing the songs as you are today. What was the process, and what did you have to square with yourself on finding that and being happy with that voice?
You know, it's actually quite literal. Like, it's me becoming, like, the lower my voice has gotten, the more comfortable I've been with writing music, because I've always kind of had this low register of singing, and I never fully owned it. I've worked in a bunch of different bands before this, and, like, we've tried pop things and 80s things and, like, wispy, girly things, but I feel like my own person when I sing in this lower register, and it slowly, once I figured that out about myself, everything else that I write makes sense.
For the people who are still finding their register, can you talk through where you at least inwardly reflected about, did it feel wrong? Did it feel off before you got to this place of comfort? How did you feel about the voice that was coming inside you? Did you try to change it? Did you feel embarrassed by it? Or what were the thoughts?
I mean, it actually sounded a lot different. Like, it's changed over, how do I say this? It's kind of like, I feel embarrassed how it used to sound. As it was happening, I didn't really analyze it too much. And people kind of would give their opinions, and that would kind of adjust. I recorded a bunch of songs when I was first moving to the city, and I remember one of my boyfriends was like, "It sounds like you're doing this with your voice." Oh yeah, I'm like weird, like just but
very Enya.
Like, yeah, like just things that I was like trying to sound. I was always trying to sound like somebody else. Everything that I'd listened to, everything that I was inspired by, and I stopped doing that. I just like slowly stopped doing that. Like, as a musician, at least for me, like I had heavy inspirations, and I always kind of tried to follow that until it helped me, because it guided me to this, to me.
You can't really control how it sounds. You can just control what you do with it.
Yes, yes, absolutely. It's kind of like love.
Oh, God. Preach on.
It's what you do with it. Yeah, like, sometimes it'll come out, and I'm like, I can't stop it. I don't know what direction it's heading in. But I can kind of sculpt it. And it's some of the songs that I've written are completely different than when I wrote them. And what makes a song special to me is when I feel like I've finished, when I closed a thought. It's like sealing the envelope and sending it away. Like, it's the best feeling in the world. But after that, then I have to add the sound in. And yeah.
Are there any songs in your repertoire that you wrote before you became okay with how your voice sounds? Did you go back and rewrite or change or adapt?
I mostly care about lyrics, honestly. I feel like words, like when they hit you in that place, it's like a stat. Like, I live for that feeling, and I always try and portray that with writing. What was your question?
Did you have to go back and adapt any old songs once you really felt and discovered your voice?
Yes, absolutely.
And how did they change?
Actually, Leonard Cohen has a really great quote about lyrics and songwriting, about how it's kind of a dance. Like, the way that you write the song, sometimes you need to change the way you sing it, and sometimes you need to cut the words a little short. It's like, I kind of feel like I do that with when I revisit songs, and I know when a song is done, but so when it hasn't reached that point yet, I still kind of go through that Leonard Cohen-y.
What does it feel like to you when it's done?
It feels like anyone in the world could tell me it's an awful song, and I could tell them to go fuck themselves.
Amazing. I think we're going to end on that. I want to thank Chef Jeremy Solomon for coming by. Elke, thank you for coming. Where can people find you? Oh, are you playing any shows in the summer?
Yes, I'm playing at Mercury Lounge on, do you know? You don't. I think it's on September 7th, and then in October, I'm playing at Ludlow House. I'll let you guys know.
Okay, where can people find you?
You could find me on Spotify, and my, talk about Instagram?
Yeah.
Instagram is at Elke Music. And Facebook. Do you guys run the Facebook? I run the Facebook. There's an Elke Facebook.
Thank you to Hector for setting this up. We appreciate it.
We love you, Hector.
Yeah, we love you, Hector. This is why we have publicists for these questions. What is the name of the last song going to play for us?
Oh, right. Okay. So this song is called... I actually don't have a name for it yet because it's kind of a new one. But let's call it Mirror.
Great. Well, thanks for listening. We will be back next week with our final episode of this season, of the summer season.
Yeah.
But then we'll be back in the fall, so...
We'll always be back.
We'll always be back. thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.
You look like you just come from doing something. A lifeline is attached to your cigarette. You mumble your mantras under your breath. You're always so quick to get upset. You gotta leave on your light. Face the world with all your might. A mirror in the dark, it only reflects black. You could summon the sun, it knows just where you're at. Darling, you're up again in your head. Mark the location on your map. Held hostage by yourself once again. Trying to tell if you're drunk when you're alone. Where you will dream of your childhood. Problems are special as you make them. A mirror in the dark only reflects black. 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 You gotta leave on your light. Face the world with all your might. A mirror in the dark, it only reflects black. You could summon the sun, it knows just where you're at. But don't worry at all, 'cause I will always, 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 always.
We talk about food, we talk about music, with musical dudes, finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.